looking to throw here. Here comes the heat. Now he steps back and on the roll, he chucks it wide open. Touchdown! The Hamilton Tiger Cats claw back here, John Childs. Second down conversion. Masoli goes deep. He's got Tolliver. He's got the touchdown. Terrence Tolliver.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
Mike Graham.
All right, Mike. So this week, I figured we could talk about, to start off the show, something that I've neglected for a few weeks, and that is how we are doing in the CFL Podcast Family Fantasy League. Haven't done one of these in a while, basically because I'm a bit of a bonehead and kept forgetting to update people on it. But long story short, Mike, bad news, we missed the playoffs. And the worst part is, we missed the playoffs by one goddamn point. So earlier in the year, the Eskimo Empire podcast and the 2 & Out CFL podcast tied. A goddamn tie in fantasy football. That's who wants a tie? Mm-hmm. That tie, unfortunately, put us in fifth place at season's end, and in our league, the top four teams were the ones that made the playoffs. This, to me, is just further evidence that ties suck. We were the highest scoring team in the league this year. Not by far, but we scored the most points, and we're on the outside looking in come playoff time because of a goddamn tie. I was not very happy about that. To be fair, however, we didn't do ourselves any favors. Our team sucked down the stretch. We finished 9-7. We were devastated by injuries, especially at wide receiver, where we lost both Chad Owens and Luke Tasker late in the year. So it was tough to come back from. But it got me thinking when I was thinking about this. Wide receiver injuries, inability to win down the stretch, a stupid tie costing us a better position in the standings. Mike, we're the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. How often does a tie happen in fantasy football? I'd have to say not very. So, yeah, that sucks, but on to next year.
We will come back next year with a fire in our belly to prove that we are the best, and hopefully we won't suffer so many injuries. I've been playing NFL fantasy football for years. We've probably had, in our 12 years of existence, maybe six ties, maybe. And even I think that's high, but... bloody tie. Man, God, it sucks.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
So one last thing before we move on to the game that I'd like to talk about. It's a little fun story I'd like to share. Earlier today, my brother was cleaning out some of the junk that we have, and he found a box full of, like, old cards. He dug through them, and it was, like, your standard fare. There was, like, sports cards, hockey cards, baseball cards, so on and so forth. For some reason, a ton of young Indiana Jones Chronicles cards. I remember that being a TV show, but I have no idea why he would have had those. But the big find was what looks to be a set of 1998 Hamilton Tiger Cats team cards that looked to be issued by the Hamilton Wentworth Police Association. So he found a couple of them. I went downstairs. We started digging through them to try to find them. We found 40 in total. I think it's kind of cool. Like, all the guys are there. McManus, Morreale, Hitchcock, Flutie. Like, you name them. The stars are all there. And I'm kind of sharing this story. One, because it's a cool Tie Cats story, piece of history. 1998, as we all remember, was a great year for this franchise. Also, I'm kind of hoping that a listener out there might know whether or not this set of 40 is the complete set. Because I kind of want to do something cool with them, like to find this relic of nearly 20 years ago. It's kind of neat. So I'm hoping that maybe someone out there can hear this story and say, yeah, that's the set. And here's something cool you might be able to do with them. I'm open to opinions. So, do you have any recollection of these cards? You were still in Hamilton in 98, obviously still a Tie Cats fan. And do you remember having these cards from the police department?
I don't. I lived about 2.5 hours away from Hamilton. So my parents had season tickets at the time. So we'd travel on game day and occasionally stay overnight. But I didn't live in Hamilton. So, yeah, I don't have any recollection. But I did have the complete series of 93 CFL cards. I remember I went to the Grey Cup with my parents and they bought me that set. So I'm not sure where it is now. It might be, you know, on my dad's place somewhere. I'm not sure. But yeah, I remember having that set and thinking it was pretty darn cool. Just, you know, you didn't see stuff like that back in the day, CFL stuff like that, you know, trading cards or boxes of cereal like you see now with CFL players on them. So it was a cool thing to have.
These cards didn't have like a Canadian flag at the top of them, did they?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to know what's spooky? Me and my brother found three Hamilton Tiger Cat cards that look exactly like the ones you're talking about. We found Tony Champion, an Earl Winfield, and another one whose name is escaping me. It's not a player that was a big star, but it had like a little Canadian flag at the top. It was like a white border. Are we talking about the same cards?
Yeah, it was either the Canadian flag at the top or the bottom. I can't remember, but I do remember that being like distinct on the card.
Okay, so I think I have a few of those here as well that we found digging through. I only shared the full set because I thought it was cool. We only found these three, but it's an Earl Winfield card that I have, and I'm really hoping that one day I get a chance to meet the guy who was my favorite Ticat player growing up. I finally have something that he can autograph. But kind of neat that we both have this sort of same. You obviously got lucky enough to get the whole set. I just have a few, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I still had them, to be honest. Any CFL memorabilia is pretty cool in my eyes. But yeah, it'd be cool to get Winfield's autograph on one of those cards. I mean, I'm not sure how he's not really around the team very often. I'm sure he lives in the States now, but he's kind of like. He's such an iconic figure with the Ticats, and he's kind of like Alan Pitts with the Stampeders. You don't really see him around that much, but he's definitely one of the greatest of all time to play on that team.
They brought him back up in 2012 to when they were closing Irvine Stadium to sort of commemorate a bunch of the older players. Yeah. And he came back. Yeah, actually, we talked about last week, the Labor Day Classic. You were there. He was there for that. Yeah. And they brought him back a couple more times since then. He's been around the team a lot more than he used to be for all those years. Cause I think he even mentioned like 2012 was the first time he had been back to the stadium since he retired. So it was a very long time. I'm hoping that there's a chance that they'll do some sort of fan thing with alumni and he'll find a way to come up here. Maybe they'll do like a Hall of Fame thing. Now that the Hall of Fame is moving to Tim Hortons Field next year. And maybe they'll do a Hall of Fame day with the Ticat players and all the living Ticats are in the Hall of Fame. It just any way that I can meet this guy would be cool. But I think it's kind of neat. Like you said, we see a lot of CFL memorabilia and little keepsakes and stuff like that now that to have some stuff from back then when they were few and far between. I think it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat to find these old relics of the past and kind of remind you of what it was like to be a fan all the way back then.
Yeah, I have two cards at my place now. It's Angelo Mosca card and Dieter Brock card. Dieter Brock is when he was with the Blue Bombers. But I remember we were in Hamilton for a game like a long time ago, and we went into a sports card shop and picked those up. The Mosca card have like the plastic around them, and the Mosca card says rookie card, but I don't think it actually is.
Wow. Wow, yeah, that'd be pretty cool if it was, though.
Yeah, I know, right?
Does he look really young on the card?
He looks young, but I think there's stats from like years past on the back of it. So
you might have to tweet these pictures out. You might have to take pictures of these cards and share them with the world.
Yeah, I think I did it a long time ago, but I could do it again.
Oh yeah, if it happened less than 30 seconds ago, people have probably already forgotten. That's the world of the internet, is it not?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so I think it's time. Waxing nostalgic is always fun, but I think we got to get into this very heartbreaking loss that our boys suffered on Friday. The Ticats lost 30-29 to Ottawa on Friday, and pretty much have all but seeded first place and the bye that comes with it to the Red Blacks. Ottawa is now 3 points up, with just three games left to play. That's a tough hill to climb, especially for a Ticats team that has now lost three straight. There's only really one place to start, right? And that is with the major controversy from this game, the fumble that wasn't. So the CFL has come out after the game and admitted that the call was blown. And that's now 2 years in a row that the Red Blacks have benefited from an officiating error in important games with the Ticats. I don't know if you remember, but I'm sure you do. Last year, Brandon Stewart had that pick six that was called back on two penalties that the league later came out and admitted should not have been called. The Ticats were going to lose that game 12-6. They would lose the series to Ottawa. Ottawa would get the home field in the East Final, and we all know how that played out. So in this game, what we had was a catch by Greg Ellingson, where he was initially ruled down by contact. Austin challenged the play. Replay showed clearly that the ball was out before any part of his body was down. The correct call, as the CFL has agreed, should have been it was ruled a catch and a fumble, and the Ticats should have had the ball inside their 10-yard line. It was near the red zone where Ellingson was hit, but it should have been the Ticats' ball. Instead, the replay official, a man by the name of Jeff Harbin, ruled that Ellingson did not have control of the ball and instead said it was incomplete. Three Down Nation had a Q&A today with Glenn Johnson, the vice president of officiating, and he was basically asked, like, how did he come to this conclusion? You can go over there and read it if you want. There's always going to be contrarians out there, and I'm sure there are many who will argue that the call was blown, but that the Ticats still had a chance to win the game, or that the call was right and it was an incomplete pass. And all that is correct, but I think that minimizes the mistake that was made. This call directly led to the winning score for the Red Blacks. Now, I'm not saying it was the reason the Ticats lost. Ken Austin will disagree with that and very, very vociferously say that that is the reason the Red Blacks won this game. But could you imagine if something like this happened in a playoff game or, heaven forbid, the Grey Cup? People would be furious and they wouldn't be saying, oh, they had another chance. People would be ticked. At the end of the day, though, there's nothing we can do about what has been done. But this does bring up renewed discussion about what the point of replay even is if they can't get calls like this right that look to be cut and dry. So, Mike, I simply ask you, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I mean, it was clearly a fumble. He caught the ball. He fell backwards for like 2.5 steps. And then it can complete control of the ball, in my opinion. And it came out and Hamilton immediately recovered it. I mean, it was a huge play in the game. And, you know, I'd have to agree with Austin. I mean, they don't get that touchdown, then we're looking pretty good. I mean, even if we, you know, get a first down or two, we still get better field position, punt the ball away, and then they have to march down the field again. So I'll have to agree with you that it's not the only reason or the main reason why we lost, but it was a contributing factor for sure. And it's just, you know, it's tough. It's really tough when you see it happen in your team. When other teams it happens to you and the fans are freaking out, you're like, oh, you know, well. But when it does happen to your team, I mean, you're biased. So it just sucks that that play, that blown call was such an important part of this game and really cost us to win.
Well, there was also, if you go back and watch the play, I'm not sure if it was Ellingson, but someone on Ottawa's receiving corps was like 5 yards offside and they completely did not call that, which would have negated this whole thing anyway, because it instead of it being an incomplete pass, it's just the whole play was a gong show. And I don't know if you watch the video that Drew Edwards posted with Steve Milton. Steve Milton says that on the sidelines, the referee was fighting for it to be a fumble. That referee is Andre Preux. And Andre Preux gets a lot of flack from fans, I think unjustly. I think he's one of the best referees that we have in this league. Some will say that's an indictment of the other referees. I think it's actually a meritorious point for him. I think he's a very good referee. And I think the more you watch him, the better you realize that he is. I think a lot, and I don't want to get into a discussion about it, but I do think a lot of it comes down to him being French-Canadian, and I think there are some biases there. But it's refereeing and officiating the replay center in the last few weeks and pretty much all season, it has been a point of contention, whether it be coaches' challenges, whether it be the new rules on what can be challenged, whether it's a fumble call here, a fumble call a week ago in the BC-Winnipeg game. I don't know what the solution is to fix this. But week after week, we keep coming back here and in some game talking about some controversy with a call on the field or a call from the booth. It's ruining the game in a sense that it's taking away, I think, some of the excitement that we get from watching sports. And if you can't trust the officials or the replay officials to get these things right, what's the point of even having it? And I do believe that there's a place in pro sports for replay. But when things like this happen, when it looks so cut and dry, when fans of other teams, I went out after the game and I ran into Red Blacks fans out and they knew who I was. I'm a recognizable guy from my work with Three Down Nation. I have a recognizable voice. We've been doing this podcast now for over 60 episodes. It's weird, but people do know who I am. They came up to me and said, man, that was a fumble like that. Well, what, like, I don't know what else to do. Like, we're glad it went our way, but it was a bad call. And if bad calls are going to continue to be made, I'd rather they be made by the officials on the field, because at least they have the excuse of it's really fast down there, it's human error. But when you have replay and the replay officials get it wrong, I start to have a problem with that.
Yeah, it just looks bad on the league. I mean, you have, you know, a lot of angles and you have all these replays that you can look at and they still don't get it right. So I'm with you. I don't understand why they even have it if it's not going to be the correct calls made. So, I mean, it was like they were afraid to go all the way with the call. You know, we'll give them the incomplete pass, but we're not going to give them the fumble and the recovery. Like, I'm not saying that they're biased against the Ticats or anything, but it just seemed that way. I mean, how could you not see that was a catch and a fumble? It's just very frustrating for a fan watching.
Well, you raise an interesting point, and I don't think it's any bias against the Ticats. I think it's the idea that people always talk about they don't want refs to decide the outcomes of games. But when turnovers happen or penalties happen, they have to be called. I don't know how much NFL you watch, but yesterday there was a great game between the Atlanta Falcons and the Seattle Seahawks where on fourth and 10, Matt Ryan heaves it up and Julio Jones goes up to grab it. And Richard Sherman, the DB for the Seahawks, is arm barring him and the referees don't throw a flag. The Falcons coach was livid. Everyone who was talking at the end of the game, all the talking heads were like, how do you not call that? Again, it makes the NFL look bad, but it's the idea that the ref will swallow a whistle. It's the same in hockey when 2 minutes left in the third period, you're not going to get the same call you're going to get at the 8 minute mark of the first, or a hack in the first quarter is not the same as a hack in the fourth quarter in basketball. But a penalty is a penalty, a fumble is a fumble. Just get it right regardless of the time. Like, you shouldn't leave it in the referee's hands to make that call, like to dictate the outcome of a game. But at the same time, if it's there, it has to be called. So that was a fumble. The Ticats should have had the ball. And the worst part is, too, if it would have been ruled a fumble on the field, Mike Daly took off with that ball. Who knows how far he gets? He might get into red-black territory. He might score if that call is called correctly instead of it being called an incomplete pass and the whistle blows. It's just all around just terrible. This was a pretty good game from an excitement standpoint. 30-29, back and forth. Ottawa took a big lead. Hamilton made that great third quarter comeback. But now again, just like we were talking about last week with BC Winnipeg, we're sitting here talking about a controversial call, and it kind of sucks, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's they should have just let plays like that. They should let the play develop. They should let it continue. Like, if they're not sure it's an incomplete pass. I know that it happened so quickly, and it's way easier to say this than actually do it. But if there's any chance that it's an actual fumble, let the play go, because you have this replay system that it's supposed to work, so you can look at it afterwards. So, it's frustrating that they were so quick to blow the whistle on that play. But who knows? They could have looked at it and came out with the same outcome. So I don't know.
Well, the fumble wasn't the only thing that happened in this game. There were another 90-some-odd plays in this game. So I want to start talking about some offense here. I don't know if the team listens to our show, Mike, but the one thing that stuck out to me from this game, even in the loss, is they finally ran the damn ball. How excited were you when on that first drive, which was a scoring drive and was absolutely beautiful, the first four plays were runs? They rushed 16 times in total in this game for 105 yards. 16 total rushes is not a lot, but they were down for a good portion of this game and forced to throw, but they still found a way to mix in the run. CJ Gable, I thought, had a great game. Carried 11 times for 66 yards, 6 yard per carry average, and he scored a touchdown. I thought he ran with poise and purpose and power. The three Ps of good running back play, I guess I'll dub it. But how happy were you that they finally ran the damn football?
I was pretty happy. I mean, that first series, like you said, was a thing of beauty. It kind of fell off after that for a while. But yeah, great to see them getting the running game, included in their game plan, because they're going to need it. We don't know how long Claros is out for, and Mazzoli, he can throw the ball, but it would be a huge benefit to him, take a lot of pressure off of him if they could hand the ball off to Gable more often, get it worked into the game plan.
Well, they proved in this game that they can do it, and they proved in this game that they can stick to it, because they ran early, and then unfortunately they got down. And this is one of the main takeaways from this game is these lulls. This, after that first drive, they didn't do a goddamn thing with the football on offense until the start of the third quarter, and yet they still lost this game by one. Like, if this team could just find a way, even if those drives that ended in punts ended in field goals, the Ticats win this football game. So again, just another area where this team, week after week, we talk about so many things with this team that they keep doing every week. Again, another big first half lull that makes this team play catch-up football.
Yeah, they're just shooting themselves in the foot with these. I mean, they didn't have a slow start. They had a first drive with a touchdown, but after that, it was a slow going. So, but one thing that was really positive, I thought, from this game was I was keeping my eye on Xavier Fulton, see how he played. And every time I watched him carefully, he was... no one was getting by him. He was owning that position and doing a great job, which made me really excited to see.
Well, that is good. I'm at the game. I was trying to pay attention to the newcomers. I spent a lot of time watching Keon Raymond because he made a lot of plays, and I'm sure you're going to talk about him when we get to the defensive side of the ball. But I didn't really notice Fulton because, again, your eyes, they drift towards what the quarterback's doing and where the ball's going and stuff like that, so it's tough. But I'm glad that you got a chance to watch Fulton and that you give him a passing grade on his first game. That's good to hear. Turnovers, again, though. Jeez, like, 3 turnovers in total, 2 interceptions, and a fumble. The Fantuz fumble, this happens frequently. Well, maybe not frequently, but a little more than I would expect for a guy who, I don't know if you've ever met Andy Fantuz, but I have, and his hands are enormous. And he is strong as a goddamn bull. How he continually gets stripped of the ball is, I don't know. But the interceptions, the first one, just, that's inexcusable. Like, the second one, when he throws deep, and the Ottawa DB made an excellent play on it. It was a little bit underthrown, but at the same time, the Ottawa defensive back still made a great play on it on a deep ball. That I can kind of forgive. That's taking a shot down the field, and if it would have paid off, it would have been awesome, but it didn't, so that happens. But the first one where he's running and he throws across his body into the middle of the field, like that, you can't make those plays as a quarterback. You simply can't.
No, that's, you know, he's not a rookie, but that was a rookie mistake. I mean, he was scrambling all over the place. You just have to throw the ball out of bounds at that point. I mean, there's nothing there. Even if he completed that pass, I mean, it wouldn't have been a first down. It was just a terrible decision on his part, and that's what we get with Mazzoli. He can play well, but then he has these terrible, terrible thoughts, the terrible decisions, and makes bad throws into traffic across, you know, against the grain. It's just not good football, and you can't be doing that down the stretch if we want to do anything this season.
No, and that's what's frustrating about him, because this guy shows flashes of brilliance. Like, you look at his numbers, 25 of 32, 278 yards, 3 touchdowns, 3 carries for 22 yards. The only blemish on his resume there is the 2 interceptions. And the thing was, is we rip him for that throw, but later in the game, if you recall, he's scrambling to the other side of the field, and he makes this jumping pass of like 23 yards that John Chiles is lying on the ground and catches, and it's like, this is why he's so frustrating to watch, because you get mad at him for making those throws, but 50-50, sometimes he comes up with them. But, man, if this guy could just cut down the turnovers, and maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, but this guy could be a really, really good quarterback, and this team's probably not mired in this slump if he can just cut down on these silly, silly turnovers.
Yeah, it's really hurting the team, but there's tons of stuff that are hurting the team. I mean, we just can't tackle anyone, so we're not on the defense yet. But
I've got one more piece of the offense that I'd like to talk about, and then you can go full bore into the defense. I want to give a shout out to a couple of players in this game, a couple of role players that I thought stepped up and had really good games, and that's John Chiles and Junior Collins. With Chad Owens and Luke Tasker out long term, both are on the 6-game injured list. Owens, we're fairly certain, is not coming back. Tasker, who knows? Someone other than Andy Fantuz or Terrence Tolliver was going to have to step up, and I thought both Chiles and Collins did that against Ottawa. The two combined for 82 yards and 2 scores. I thought both made some clutch catches. I was very happy with their respective performances. It was nice to see a couple of guys that aren't expected to be stars step up in this game and make some key plays in this game. The Collins touchdown catch was, like, that was a beautiful throw, but that was also an incredible catch.
Yeah, right at the back of the end zone. I was waiting for him to step up, and I think this game he did. So, yeah, and like you said, Chiles made some plays too. So it's good to see those guys getting more comfortable in the offense, and maybe they can help this team out down these last 3 games.
Well, and don't forget, we still have Kevin Elliott waiting in the wings there. So right. At some, like, I know we've lost Owens, I know we've lost Tasker, but I think a Tolliver, Fantuz, Chiles and Elliott Collins, I think that's a pretty darn good receiving group, even for guys that haven't been here very long. So yeah, it was great to see these guys step up, and there's a guy who's ready to step up that hasn't been on the field yet that could contribute in future games that we'll have to wait and see. So that's it for the offense for me, Mike. You brought up tackling. I knew you were going to do that, because that was kind of my main takeaway from this defensive performance. But what do you got to talk about the defense?
Like we talked about, they just can't, they're not wrapping up, they're giving other teams huge yardage when it should be stopped before the first down. I mean, this team really needs to step up and just tackle some people. I mean, come on, you've been playing football your whole lives, this is what you learn how to tackle when you're very young. Let's start tackling, please, and let's start covering better. I mean, once again, we have the game in our hands, and a team just marches down the field on us and wastes the clock. We can't stop. We can't cover. We can't tackle. It's pretty depressing out there.
Emmanuel Davis, to me, is the guy that stands out for the tackling problem.
Yeah.
I had him marked down for 3 missed tackles, all of which contributed to either big plays or scoring plays for the Red Blacks. And it sucks to rip a guy like Davis, because I think he has had a pretty good season. And he was an all-star last year, but man, his tackling was piss poor. And a guy like Larry Dean had a big missed tackle deep in Ticats territory. Let Moses Madu get away from him and set up at the goal line, and the very next play was a touchdown. So again, Dean's a pretty sure tackler. He's been probably the best defensive player in the linebacking core this year, and that's saying something when Simone Lawrence is back there. But yeah, the tackling just wasn't there. The coverage is what, like, this defense used to be predicated on creating turnovers and solid tackling, and they're not really doing much of either this year. They're getting better at sacking the quarterback, but I think I'd trade the sacks in for turnovers and stopping guys instead of allowing all these yak from these Ottawa receivers. Like, they threw for almost 400 yards, and Ottawa had nearly 200 of that in yak alone. You just can't have that.
No, what's happened? I mean, last year they were a dominant defense. 1-2, Edmonton and Hamilton, where you could go either way who was the best defense in the league, and we're not even close this year. It's just fundamentals that aren't working, like tackling. And I don't know if it's, you know, I'm not a defensive expert. I don't know certain schemes or whatnot that Steinhauer is using, but have teams figured out what he's doing? I'm not sure.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Is this a guy who's been in this position now 4 years? I think he's done a very good job for most of the 4 years here, but could it be the same thing with the offense as well? Have teams just figured out what Austin and his coordinators like to do, and now they know how to attack it? I don't know, but it's weird because some weeks it looks like this team, both defensively and offensively, can't be stopped, and then the next week they couldn't score or stop the team from scoring if their life depended on it. It's just very frustrating to watch how this team, both offensively but especially defensively, it's so up and down.
They've just fallen off the map. You know, the injuries are a big part of it on offense, but and we lost players on the defensive side of the ball. But I had total faith at the start of the season that this defense would, you know, bring in guys that were really good replacements, and, you know, maybe we wouldn't be as good as we were last year, but we'd still be at the top or near the top of the league on the defensive side of the ball. But it just hasn't happened that way, and I don't have very much confidence in this defense right now.
Neither do I. What did you think about Keon Raymond, Mike?
I thought he was great. He was the best tackler on the field by far. He made some really impressive plays, you know, tackling people for losses. He looked crisp out there. He looked like the old Keon Raymond. He looked like the guy that was with Toronto and Calgary. So I was overly impressed with how he played compared to everyone else on the defensive side.
He showed some great closing speed on a couple of tackles that really impressed me. And from where I was sitting, it looks like he came within a cat's whisker of fulfilling my prophecy of him getting a pick six. Was it as close as it looked to me on TV? Because it looked like he was like maybe a couple of inches short from snagging that ball and going the other way.
When I was watching it live, I thought that he was going to run in there and grab it. But yeah, it was pretty darn close. He read the play and almost made the interception.
Yeah, I was watching him most of the game. I got to the game super early and was watching him in warmups. My eyes were focused on number 11 because, as I said, I've been such a huge fan of this guy for so many years. It's just nice to see him wearing the good colors. So I was definitely focused on him defensively, and I too was very impressed with how he played in this game. Anything else in the defense you want to touch on?
I keep being impressed with John Chick. He's just, I say it week after week, but he just keeps bringing it and having a better year than I ever would have thought that he would have.
Do you think maybe he's going to be this team's nominee for most outstanding player? Not just most outstanding defensive player, but most outstanding player.
That's interesting. I can see it. I mean, no one really stands out on offense. You know, maybe one of the receivers would have if they didn't get injured. Maybe Fantuz. But yeah, I could see that. I mean, he's been solid all year long. So he's been the best player on the team all year long.
Yeah, it's for me, it's between him and Andy Fantuz. Because I not just for the team, but for the division. Like, if you look at all the teams in the East, can you pick out? All the quarterbacks have either, like, Montreal, no. Ottawa keeps shuffling guys back and forth, so you're not going to give it to either of them. Toronto has been a complete dumpster fire when it comes to the quarterback position, and Hamilton can't keep guys in the lineup at quarterback either. So usually it's the quarterbacks that guys will go towards. So now you're looking at the teams and going, this is a race that's wide open. A guy like Chick or Fantuz could not just win the Ticats Award. They could be the nominee for the East. They won't win the award. I think we can already start etching Bo Levi Mitchell's name on the award right now. But for either one of those two guys to win the East nomination for most outstanding player, I think would be a major coup.
Yeah, I could also see maybe Sean Lemon from Toronto, maybe being the defensive player. He just racked up so many sacks. I think he has more than Chick, but it seems like every game he's getting one or two. So he can maybe be a nominee as well.
Yeah, it's really tough this year, and it's going to be interesting when those ballots are handed out and when they are announced who the guys are, because it's definitely something that's interesting me as we head down the tail end of the season here. So if you're ready to go on to special teams, I am as well, because there's obviously a big special teams play that we have to talk about.
Yeah, I'm ready.
The missed field goal. Yeah. I got to be honest, I feel really bad for Brett Maher for having to wear the goat horns here, but the fact of the matter is he has to make those kicks. It was a 47-yard field goal. We saw him make a 58-yard field goal a couple weeks ago, so these 47 ones, while not easy, you still have to make it. In fact, if he makes that kick, maybe that botched call on the fumble doesn't matter. Maybe the Ticats take the lead and they find a way to get a stop on defense. I'm not sure they would have, but maybe they do, and the Ticats win this football game. But he missed it, and my big takeaway from this is I really hope this doesn't shatter his confidence, because I think, and we've talked about it on the show since week one, I think he's mostly been excellent for the Ticats this year, and it looks especially bad when the guy that he replaced went 7-for-7 later in the night and is like, what, 5 field goals away from setting the record for field goals in the season. But I was in the stands and it went wide and everyone around me started cheering because they thought it was in, and I was like, he missed it. And I was just, I knew at that point the game was over. I did not have any confidence that this defense would make a stop and get the ball back. And as we find out, I was right. So yeah, it just sucks.
Yeah, it's tough. He, like you said, he's been awesome all year long. Even if he made the field goal, I mean, the next, you know, things could have changed, but he missed it, and then they still drove down the field to, like, the 2-yard line. So even if he makes it, if that happens and they hit a last-second field goal, and it doesn't matter anyways.
No,
but you're right that he has to make those kicks.
He does, and the thing is, and this, again, I'm not hanging it all on one play or like we said with the botched fumble, it wasn't that one play. This missed field goal also isn't that one play. The Red Blacks have Chris Melo, and this guy missed a 30-yard field goal in overtime the week before, so it's not like this guy is Mr. Automatic. Even if they did drive down the field, who knows if he actually hits the kick? You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I don't know. It's just there's just a little more comfort in the fact that they would have been up, what, 30?
28. Or 29. Something like that.
What the hell did I? No, final was 30-29, so they would have been up 31-30. So even though it still would have meant Ottawa, even with a single, could have tied the game and sent overtime, there just is more confidence that they would have maybe gotten out of this with a victory, but who knows? With the way the defense was playing, it probably was not going to happen. Interesting thing, though, and I want to get your opinion on this, because I kind of thought about it at the end of the game. Do you think that the Red Blacks should have tried to score on that last drive? I know that with their tie, it's highly unlikely that these two teams end up tied in the standings at the end of the year, barring something like, unless the Ticats tie, that it can't happen. But say it does, and say Hamilton goes into Ottawa this week and wins by 6. If the Red Blacks would have tried to score there, they would have won probably by 8. The point differential matters in these 2-point series. And again, like I said, I understand that the tie makes things a little wonky. I think if I was Ottawa's head coach there, I still would have gone for the score. You?
Oh, yeah. Well, we both know that if the tables were turned, Austin would have went for that score, guaranteed. So, yeah, I think that they should have went for it. Like, it's not running up the score if the total points matter. So, yeah, kneeling down at the 2-yard line or whatever it was probably not the smartest decision on their part. I understand they just want to, you know, get out of there with a win. But, you know, barring a catastrophe, I don't think we're going to run it back 98 yards for a touchdown or anything. So if I were him, I would have tried to get the points, because you never know what's going to happen.
I would have been okay with them, even if they were at like the 30-yard line. And if they would have been, that's where they would have been stopped, and it would have been the last play of the game. The game is over. They've won the game. Them kicking a field goal. Like, the points, this is a 2-game total point series. And this will be the third time I say it. I understand, because people have come up to me and said it. I understand that the Ottawa tie makes the chances of these two teams finishing in the standings with the same record highly unlikely. But it's not impossible. We've seen one tie this year. We could see another. It can happen. So I just think that Ottawa should have tried to score. If they lose the next game by 3 points, they're going to be pretty pissed off that they lost the season series to the Ticats because they didn't try to punch it in the end of the game.
Yeah, all the blame will be on Campbell if that happens.
Yeah, could you imagine if they lose this game, Hamilton somehow finds a way to get above them, and it's like man, if we would have scored more, we would have had to. And again, who knows what's going to happen for the rest of the season? I just think it'll be he'll be a bit on the hot seat if for some miraculous reason these two teams do end up tied with points in the standings and Hamilton somehow wins the season series. He's going to look like kind of an idiot. But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah, he'll be having his feet to the fire for sure.
Probably. I have an interesting question for you. So as I was leaving the game on Friday, a fan came up to me, told me he loved our show, said he thought we were doing a great job. But he wanted us to discuss something. He is of the opinion that this season will be Brandon Banks' final season in Hamilton. Do you agree with that assessment, Mike?
Well, I'm assuming that this is his last year of his contract then?
It's not. He's got one more year left.
Okay. I think they keep him around. I think he still has that breakaway speed. I think that, he can turn the field position around at any point. But, it just hasn't been there this year. I don't know if it's the blocking or what's the deal. But I have to say that I think he'll be around next year. I think they'll keep him around for at least another year.
I think because he has a year left on his contract, I'd be kind of surprised if they let him go. Maybe if they had a guy like Sinkfield, like if they would have brought Terrell Sinkfield back, maybe that would have been – okay, well, you can use Sinkfield on punts as well, although Sinkfield has turned into a really good receiver.
Yes, they do have Lawrence now, eh?
They do have Kendall Lawrence, that's true. But like when we saw him in Saskatchewan, he wasn't very good. I don't know if he'd be – but who knows? He was great in Edmonton, so anything's possible. I don't necessarily disagree. I wouldn't be shocked if he was released because of the money they're paying him and they're not getting tons of output, although he does have 4 return touchdowns this year, which still leads the league. So he's still a pretty darn good – kick returner. We just haven't seen a lot of it lately. I thought it was an interesting question. I really wish I would have got the reasons why this fan thought. I really wish I would have got his name as well. I'm usually just so surprised when people actually run into me and recognize me. But like I said, like distinctive look, distinctive voice, I kind of get it. But it's still just kind of weird that people run into me. And my friends are even like my one friend, she turned to me when after it happened. She goes, "That'll never not be weird." And I was like, "What? That people recognize me?" She's like, "Yes, that will always be strange." And I agree with her. It's weird to me. I'm not someone who likes to really go out of my way to talk to strangers. I'm a little bit of an introvert in that way. So it is a little weird when people do recognize me, come up to me. But it was an interesting question. He obviously is a listener of the show because he says he loves what we do. I figure this is a great way to get listeners in. We always want to get listeners involved. So yeah, I would, like I said, to kind of answer the question, wrap it all up in one little sentence here. I wouldn't be shocked if he's gone, but I think he'll still be here.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, anything can happen. But yeah, I'd be a little bit surprised, but not overly shocked if he wasn't here.
Okay, so let's turn the page on this game. We got another one coming up that we'll discuss a little bit later, but there's some news that we have to get out of the way first. Ticats stuff obviously will come before the CFL stuff, although there was some big CFL news today. The big news out of Ticats, of course, always injury-related, because that's what seems to be what we always talk about with this team. Zach Caleros has officially been ruled out for the rematch against Ottawa. That means Jeremiah Mazzoli will get the start again. If he plays like he did last Friday but eliminates those turnovers, I like the Ticats' chances. Let's see if he can do that. 2 other names on the injury list that did not play or did not participate in practice today. We got Andy Fantuz and Terrence Campbell. It's Monday, so it's possible that both those could just be maintenance days, though if you recall, Campbell did get hurt during the game on Friday and had to leave the game. I believe they kicked Ryan Bomben out to tackle, and they had Revenberg and Diakowski in a guard, so they had a 4 Canadian offensive line. The big one, though, is Fantuz. This team can ill afford to lose Fantuz. If they don't have him, I don't think they have any chance of beating Ottawa on Friday.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it's just a maintenance day type thing, and he's back because he's been so great over these last 3 weeks. The number one guy in the offense, Tolliver took over that spot this week, but he's been awesome. So if we lost him, that'd be a terrible thing for this team. And just when you said Revenberg, I remember there was this one play in the game last week that he made an awesome block. He ran down the field, made a block for Gable, I believe it was. That really impressed me. I don't know if you remember the play, but it just showed the guys, he's a big dude. Obviously, he's an offensive lineman, but he has some speed for an offensive lineman. And just the versatility that he has, it makes me happy that we drafted him.
Yeah, it's really making Austin look like a genius for trading up to get that kid because he looks like he's going to be a stalwart on this offensive line for a very long time. The thing with Fantuz, too, that really bums me out is he is 8 yards away from his first 1,000-yard season since 2010, and he's 7 catches away from 100, and he would become the first Ticat in history to catch 100 passes in a season. How crazy is that?
Yeah, well, they've been around. I mean, are they counting the Wildcats and the Tigers or whatever, or does that?
I'm not entirely sure. Although when those teams played, they basically ran the ball every play. Like, I know the CFL is more passing league, but I don't know what they're considering Tiger Cat history, but that's just what I read.
Even if it is just when they amalgamated into one team, that's still a lot of years and a lot of great players. So that's a huge accomplishment for him.
Yeah, and again, with how Owens played, to lose him sucked. The way Tasker was playing, to lose him sucks. If this team's not going to go anywhere, at least we could have the thrill of Andy Fantuz going over 1,000 yards for the first time in his Ticats career, for the first time since 2010, and becoming the first Ticat in history to catch 100 passes. I would hate to see us lose him for the rest of the season and him not reach those milestones, because this season has been tough for us Ticat fans. I want a little glimmer of hope, a little glimmer of sunshine, and Andy Fantuz doing those things would be, when we look back on this year, go, yeah, you know what? It ended without a Grey Cup championship. It ended with a one and done in the playoffs or whatever it was. But hey, Andy Fantuz had a hell of a year, and it was great to watch him play. I want to keep that. I want that at least.
Yeah, hopefully he's back. If not this week, then next, and he can get those numbers.
Yeah. So thankfully, the Ticats did not make a slew of moves this week that we have to talk about. I guess they got that all out of their system last week, but that doesn't mean there wasn't moves around the league. The big one, obviously. Daron Carter and Kenny Stafford, given the heave-ho by the Montreal Alouettes. There's a lot to unpack in this one. So here's the thing, is that both players were let go, and neither of them will be paid for the remainder of the season because neither of them are considered fourth-year veterans. But also because of this weird CFL rule, neither will be allowed to play for another team this season since they were released after the trade deadline. Personally, I think this rule is idiotic. But some argue that this is there to avoid teams trading players under the table. I just think in a post-salary management system CFL, teams wouldn't really do this, especially with veteran players when it could risk messing up their cap. You know, like, these guys aren't being paid, but if they were both fourth-year players and they wanted to get rid of them, they would be. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's a stupid rule as well. With the salary cap, it pretty much negates what you're talking about there. And we talked about it before we started recording, and the last instance I remember is the Troy Davis trade to Edmonton. When Edmonton went on that Grey Cup run, Hamilton kind of, you know, helped them out with Troy Davis and maybe another player I can't recall. But
I think it was Joe Montford. I think they traded Joe Montford there too.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Yes. So two pretty darn good players that helped the Eskimos out, and then voila, the next season we have Jason Moss, supposedly our next great quarterback. But yeah, that's the last instance I remember of kind of like under the table type deal in the CFL. So it doesn't happen often, and hasn't happened since then, unless I don't recall a trade happening. But yeah, I think they should be paid for the rest of the season. I mean, they're with their team for, you know, 15, 16 games, whatever it is now, and then all of a sudden they don't get paid for the rest of the season. It kind of sucks for them. But on the other side, I think it's interesting that Alouettes are getting rid of Carter. Stafford's a good player too, but Carter is like top echelon type receiver in this league, and I don't know what his NFL opportunities are, if they're still there or not, but I think any team would take a chance on him just to take a look, see if they can fix his attitude problems and all that, because the guy is just a great football player.
He very much is, and I got some numbers here that might blow your mind in a second, but I just want to ask you this. I need someone to explain to me how it is fair that a player at this point in the season can get cut, not get paid, and not be allowed to play somewhere else. They can sign, like they could sign with a team, but they aren't allowed on the 46-man roster. So what does that really leave? A practice roster spot, which doesn't pay much, or they get put on the six-game injured list or the one-game injured list, and then we talk about how, oh, it's just a team signing a player and stat. Like, then that gets the Bush League comments there too. Like, I think it's really unfair to the players that this can happen, and I think this is something that needs to be changed the next time the CBA is negotiated. Like you said, you bring up the Jason Mosch, Troy Davis, Edmonton Hamilton thing, and that was in, like, I think 2005. Mm. That was before there was a salary cap. You just don't see these types of moves. Like, you're not going to see a team, like I said, cut a guy, especially a veteran player who they're going to owe money to help out another team for some under the table backdoor trade. I just think that this is a rule that It just it served its purpose maybe in the 1970s and 1980s when teams could spend what they wanted to, and this was a little bit more of a Wild West than it was a cohesive unit. But I just think in a salary cap era, there's no point to having this rule, and I think it's really unfair to the players. Like, Daron Carter and Kenny Stafford now get to sit at home and not get paid and not be employed. And yeah, some of it's their own doing, but they've been cut. Why should another team not be able to scoop them up and reap the benefits of the team they were on not wanting them? It just seems wholly unfair.
Yeah, and maybe a deliberate move by the Alouettes to cut these guys after the trade deadline. It's not like they kind of are still in the playoff hunt, but that's just the dismal ways of the East right now. But yeah, it doesn't seem right. There's a lot of contract rules and that are just not fair to the players. So yeah, that's just the way of pro football, I guess.
Yeah, so maybe this next time the CBA is open, this is something that will be negotiated. We'll have to wait and see. But the big thing that I want to talk about with these guys is their players on the field. They're two very good receivers. Like, let's not forget that. These are two guys that can play ball. Kenny Stafford had like 9 touchdowns last year with the Eskimos, helping them win the Grey Cup. Carter is Carter. These are good players. So I got to ask, we're a Ticats podcast. The obvious question is this. Would you sign either of these two guys for next year?
I'd take a chance on Carter if you can bring him in. Yes, he's a prima donna. Yes, he seems to be a me guy, but that talent it's worth taking a shot at. If he doesn't mesh with the team, I mean, like you just saw, we can just outright cut him and not lose any money. So I don't see it as a bad idea bringing in a guy like Jerron Carter who can be such a game changer. So I'd like to see them maybe take a look at him. I mean, why not?
The dude might be the very definition of a knucklehead, Mike, but his numbers speak for themselves. Here's what he did. He's played 30 career games, 185 catches, 2,877 yards, and 17 TDs. For a comparison's sake, Adarius Bowman, who I think we can probably all agree has been the best receiver in the league the last 3 years, right?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
He's at least in the conversation. He's led the league in receiving, will lead the league in receiving again. I think he led the league in receiving last year. Maybe Eric Rogers did. Anyway, he's been in the top 5 in receiving yards the last 3 years. He's been great. His last 30 games, 191 catches for 2,732 yards and 14 TDs. So that's six more catches, but fewer yards and fewer touchdowns. And the thing we have to remember is Adarius Bowman has been catching passes from the guy that TSN said was the number one player in the entire CFL last year. You know who Carter has caught all his passes from? Take this septet on, for instance. Tanner Marsh, Josh Nieswander, Troy Smith, Alex Brink, Jonathan Crompton, Rakeem Cato, and Kevin Glenn. Not one of those guys is Mike Riley. So if Carter can post similar and better numbers than Bowman with that craptastic group of quarterbacks, minus Kevin Glenn, because I still think Kevin Glenn's a pretty good quarterback, imagine what numbers he could put up if he had a quarterback like Zach Caleros or Jonathan Jennings or Mike Riley or Bo Levi Mitchell or Trevor Harris. Like, this guy has put up numbers with garbage. Put him with a quarterback that can actually play. The sky's the limit for this kid. Yeah, he is a moron. He has done some really stupid stuff, but the talent is there. And if he has any interest in joining the Ticats, I would take a shot on him. This is a locker room that can reform, quote-unquote, bad boys. Happened with Terrell Sinkfield. I look at this team in a similar way to the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick. You bring a guy in into a good locker room, it might turn him around. He's not going to expect to be the leader of this team. He's going to just get to go out there and play ball. The Patriots did this with a supposed malcontent Randy Moss. And the first year Randy Moss was in New England, he set the record for touchdown catches in a season, and Tom Brady set the record for touchdown passes in a season. Mm-hmm. This could be very similar. Could you imagine a receiving group of Luke Tasker, Andy Fantuz, Terrence Tolliver, or maybe he replaces Tolliver. Maybe Tolliver gets a shot at the NFL. And Daron Carter? Whew. That is something that would make teams really, really worried to play this Ticats team.
Yeah, that'd be pretty scary. I'd have to say that if all those guys could stay healthy, they could do what Ottawa's been doing for the last 2 years, getting, 4,000-yard receivers easily. So, yeah, it's scary to think what he could have done with a good team around him, a solid quarterback. You name those guys at quarterback, and it makes you shudder just thinking about their quarterback play. Nieswander, Tanner Marsh, I mean, that's the first guy I called a bozo on this show. So
it was. He was indeed the impetus for the bozo of the week. You're right.
Yeah, and what a, what a terrible quarterback he was. And Crompton, I believe that he just kind of threw it up for Carter, and he just went and got it most of the time. So this guy's put up some great numbers, like you said, and if he had Caleros throwing him the ball, or pretty much any other quarterback, he would be setting records, I think.
Well, the thing is, if you look at that list of quarterbacks that he's caught passes from Montreal, not a single one of them are a starting quarterback in the CFL today. Rakeem Cato is being benched in favor of Vernon Adams. Marsh, Nusswinder, Smith, and Brink are all out of the league. Maybe Marsh might still be in Montreal, but I don't think he is. Glenn's a backup now in Winnipeg. Cato's a backup. And Crompton hasn't seen the field since the first game of last season. I don't even know if he's still injured. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on with him. None of those guys are starting quarterbacks. So, man, if he could get with a guy, a quarterback that can sling the ball, and a guy that could throw deep like a Riley or a Mitchell, like, whew, could you imagine him with Jonathan Jennings? Like, I hope he comes to Hamilton, but I think he can be successful anywhere he goes. I don't want to give short shrift to Kenny Stafford either. I like him, and if he signed with Ticats, I wouldn't be all that upset. But of these two, I think the guy you got to get is Carter, because he's the guy with the most talent.
Yeah, I like Stafford too. He had a great season last year, and you know, he's been injured for a lot of this year, but I think he's a solid receiver, just not as talented as Carter.
Yeah, I'm really kind of...
I think they're cousins too, aren't they?
They are, and I wonder if that's part of the reason why they were both let go. They had that antagonistic relationship with Rakeem Cato, and it looks like the team has chosen Cato. Even if he might not be the starter, they've kind of chosen him over the two receivers, because you can kind of always find receivers, although finding a guy of Carter's talents is not easy. But, you know, it's maybe that's kind of the reason why they're out of there. But these two guys are now free agents, and it'll be interesting to see if any team kind of brings them in, even if just to get them into the facility for 4 or 5 weeks or whatever, and see if they can kind of acclimate themselves to a team. And it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely didn't expect that to happen today.
So we forgot to cover this when we talked about the replay, but your Bozo of the Week was the replay guy, correct? Right.
The Bozo of the Week is the replay officials, the officials on the field, just the whole collective for, you know, blowing that call and costing the Ticats, well, helping to the Ticats loss. So, you know, it was just, we talked about it. It was pretty obvious call to make, and to go to a replay and still not see it is very Bozo-ish.
Yeah, very Bozo-worthy. We were just both so pissed off at what happened that I guess it slipped our minds, but that's okay. So, let's get right into it, Mike. Ticats game preview. They're playing the Red Blacks again this week. We enter must-win territory for the first time this year. If the Ticats want to have a shot at finishing first in the East, they literally have to win this game. If Ottawa is to win this game, they clinch first place in the East and the bye that comes with it. However, the Ticats can still clinch a playoff spot this week, even if they lose, so long as both the Alouettes and the Argonauts both lose. So, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's unlikely, I think...
Default.
The two greatest words in the English language.
I
think it's kind of unlikely that this team is going to miss the playoffs. So even while being 3 points back, which are 3 games left to play, they still will probably not win the division. But barring something completely unforeseen, they will make the playoffs. It'll be the fourth straight year they make them, and the seventh time in the last 8 seasons, which is, I know there's no Grey Cup championships there, and I don't think this team has what it takes to win a Grey Cup this year, but it's still kind of nice that we're at the end of the season and still talking about this team, and we're going to have meaningful football in mid-November. That is not something we were used to in the decade prior to this. So I understand frustration amongst many Ticats fans, and I'm with them on this, that this team looks like they're as talented as they are and to win a championship. But 7 playoff appearances in 8 seasons and 4 straight, it beats being where we were in 2005 and 2006.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, I talked about it on previous episodes that I really wanted this team to be above 500, but just make it to 500. Just be 99, and I'll be okay with that. You know, 8-10, I don't want that, but 3 in a row, make it 9-9, and, you know, I won't feel any shame if we win a championship at 9-9, that's for sure.
I won't. This team could go 1-17 if they somehow miraculously made the playoffs with that. I still wouldn't feel any shame if they won the Grey Cup. But yeah, you I know how you feel. We're in the same boat here. We want this team to be dominant, like we saw again. We always go back to this, like we saw in that summer of last year. Like we want that team to be the team that we are cheering for week in, week out. We want them to be like Calgary, and that's hard to do. That's hard to do. That Calgary program has been built up over basically 2.5 decades since pretty much Wally Buono walked in there. They have been a Grey Cup contender and a playoff team almost every year. So That's what we wanted this team. We're not getting it this year, so we kind of have to take what we get. A 9-9 finish in second place in the East, or a 9-9 finish in first place in the East would be fine with me. If they can find a way to get into the playoffs, which they probably will, I'm still going to be happy, because playoff football means we give a crap about this team in November, which, like I said, was not what we were doing in the middle part of the last decade. So I'll take it. So let's dig into this game, Mike. What are your keys to the game on the offensive side of the ball?
Mazzoli has to not turn over the ball. We pretty much talk about it every time Mazzoli plays, but he can't be – listen, I know that it's part of his game to be that scrambling quarterback, to make plays on the go. And we talked about the both sides of it, you know, the early interception last week in the game where he was scrambling around and then threw up a ball that he shouldn't have and was picked off. And then later in the game where he's doing the same thing and he tosses up a ball while he's jumping like Doug Flutie used to do, and John Chiles makes the catch. So you're going to get it both ways with him, but limit it to like one interception, you know. It can't be multiple, or this, or Ottawa's gonna jump on that. He's gonna take advantage of it. So if he can, limit the turnovers, we should be, you know, in a close game like we were last week. Keep running the ball with Gable. That's, you know, he had success last week. Keep doing that, and take some pressure off of Mazzoli. He can't be throwing like he's Claros back there. He's just not the same player. It's not a knock on him. He's just a different player than Zach Claros. So those two things, and keep, you know, the left tackle position, Xavier Fulton. I may be wrong on this, but from what I saw, he was dominating the pass rusher. So he had pretty good protection that game. And if they can keep doing that, give Mazzoli some time, he can make things happen with his legs. And we've seen that he can pass the ball pretty well when he's in a groove. So, you know, protect him, run the ball, and limit turnovers.
Yeah, like, run the ball especially. Like, they had 32 passes to 16 runs. I'd like to see that be a little closer, maybe 28 passes. And also, they should run more plays. Like, they turned the ball over, and that's why they didn't run as many plays as they should have. But if they can get that, I'm not saying 50-50 because that's ridiculous, but like 65-35, even 60-40 wouldn't be so bad. But they're at 66% passed, 33% run. They can get that a little bit closer, I think I'd be happy. But yeah, I think you nailed all the things this team needs to do offensively to get the win here. Defensively, Mike, this team pretty much just needs to do exactly what they didn't do last Friday. They need to tackle better. Like we said, Manuel Davis and Larry Dean had some key missed tackles in the loss last Friday. And this team just needs to get back to that sure tackling machine they were from 2013 to 2015. We talked about Keon Raymond. He was the one guy I thought did tackle well. His closing speed, as I mentioned before, on a pair of tackles was really good. He led the team with 7 tackles, so he definitely came to play. And like we said, he came oh so close to getting that pick six. So I'm going to predict that he's going to do it again. I'm going to predict that Keon Raymond will intercept Smiling Hank as Smiling Hank has one of those typical bad Hank games, and Raymond takes it to the house. I'm going to be at this game in Ottawa, so I think it'll be even sweeter to do it on the road. And hopefully maybe it's one of those ones where he gets the big pick near the end of the game to kind of seal a victory. I'd really like that. So I'm going to predict that Raymond will get the interception this week off Hank and take it to the house. And I'm probably going to predict every week that he's going to do it until he actually does it. Another thing is, though, they need to get pressure. They did not really pressure Henry Burris all that much. And when Burris is pressured, he makes mistakes. And as we saw, the big strip sack that John Chick had that Larry Dean recovered was a major turning point in that game. Took points off the board for Ottawa. So, no, Burris' MO his entire career is when he's pressured, he makes mistakes. So you get in his face and he'll turn the ball over or make really stupid plays, and that can help the Ticats win. And again, this all comes down to creating turnovers. If they can tackle better, if they can pressure Burris, they can hopefully then create some turnovers, because this team is going to need to steal some possessions from the Red Blacks if they're going to win this game. Ottawa's offense is really, really good. So they need to find a way for the defense to get the ball off Ottawa's offense, set the Ticats up in a short field, which will allow the offense to score some points and hopefully get this win. So my three keys here: tackle better, pressure Hank, and create turnovers.
Yeah, I really hope you're right about that pick six, because this team needs every point they can get from any side of the ball, special teams, defense, offense. So for the defense to score a touchdown, that would be a huge deal for this team, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing that they have to do, and this is just a catch-all, is do not leave this in the hands of the officials to win this game. find a way to do it on the field. Let's put the replay nonsense to bed. Let's not use that. Let's not need that. Let's just go out there, kick some butt, and get the W on the field, and don't let the officials have a say in who wins or loses this game.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Mike, you ready to put those picks out there for the world?
Yep.
All right, so we got the top three after week 17 are the exact same as the top three after week 16. Cappy D still leads this by a wide margin with 9,848 points. Andrew, our pick'em commish, sits in second place at 8,447 points, and I myself sit in third place at 7,950 points. Mike, you stayed in 17th spot with 5,153 points. We got four games as always this week. So let's start with the first game that kicks off the week, and that is the game that features our Hamilton Tiger Cats heading to the nation's capital to take on the Ottawa Red Blacks. Mike, who do you like in this one?
I got Ottawa, obviously, in my heart. I want the Tiger Cats to win. I'm cheering for them. I just don't think that they're going to pull it out. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't really have much confidence in this team right now.
I'm going to go against you. I'm taking the Tiger Cats, but this is a homer pick. This really is a heart pick. If I was a neutral observer, I don't think there's any way that I would take the Tiger Cats in this game, but I just can't, in my heart, say that I'm going to pick Ottawa against Hamilton. So I'm probably going to get this one wrong, and I accept that, and you're probably going to win this one up on me, but yeah, I got to take the Tiger Cats.
So, yeah, I take the loss over, you know, a Tiger Cats win any day. So I really hope I'm wrong on this, because I want them to, you know, have a three-game winning streak and get to 9-9 and roll into the playoffs on a good note. So fingers crossed that I'm wrong.
I completely agree. Fingers crossed you are wrong. The second game, which is also Friday night, and this is weird, it actually starts while the first game is still on. The Ottawa-Hamilton game kicks off at 7. This game kicks off at 9. So this one is the Argos heading to Calgary to take on the Stampeders. They moved the start time of this game for some reason. So people are saying because it's, I guess, super cold in Calgary right now, but I don't know if that's the case. BC plays a game on Saturday night. Why isn't the BC game Friday night, and then you have the Calgary game? I don't know. This is one of those things. I can't remember the last time two CFL games went on at the same time where one like didn't go into overtime or something like that. So this is kind of weird and ticks me off. I was going to miss some of this game anyway, because by the time the Ottawa-Hamilton game ended and I got back to my hotel room in Ottawa, this game was probably going to be at halftime anyway, but now I'm going to miss even more of it. So hopefully you got your eyes keyed on this one so you can let me know if anything cool happens. But I'm mostly just rambling here because I know we're both picking Calgary, so just make it official.
Yeah, Calgary. Calgary all the way. I mean, Toronto's in shambles. Drew Willey's a quarterback that has completely lost his confidence, and well, he's not going to even be playing. So,
oh yeah, that's right. Ricky Ray's probably going to start this one.
Yeah, but even so, you got to go with Calgary.
Yeah, I don't think it makes a damn bit of difference. They could resurrect the corpse of Sam Echeverry or Ron Lancaster, or go into a time machine and find Russ Jackson from the '60s and put him in this game. I still think the Stamps roll over the Argos. So yeah, let's just move on to the next one, which is Saturday afternoon. One of the last games at Mosaic Stadium, the Riders host the Montreal Alouettes. Are the Riders going to get to a four-game winning streak? Or would it be five? Are they already? No, they've won four in a row, haven't they?
I think so.
This would be five. Are they going to get push that winning streak to five games, Mike?
I think they are. Vernon Adams starting for the Alouettes this week. You know, a lot of talk about him in the offseason. You know, big star down in the NCAA. We don't know what kind of quarterback he is up here yet, so... Yeah, his first game starting. Saskatchewan's hot. Maybe one of the hottest teams in the league right now, if not the hottest team. So I'm going to go with them. I think they roll over the troubled Alouettes.
I'm with you there, which means, if you recall what we just talked about, if Calgary wins and Saskatchewan wins, the Ticats are playoff bound, sir. So if our predictions hold true here, we will be celebrating the Ticats making the playoffs next week, even if they get in through the back door. I don't care how they get in, just as long as they get in. The final game of the week, I think this one is the best game. I think this one is so close to call. Probably the game that's going to decide who crosses over, because now that Winnipeg, who's on a bye this week, is in firm control of second place in the West, could be Edmonton or BC heading over. So we have the Eskimos heading to Vancouver to play the Lions. Mike, who you got in this one?
The Lions have, the last couple of weeks, they've had wins, and Jennings is throwing the ball away, throwing the game away, basically, making dumb decisions. I'm going to have to go with the Lions at home. I think that they're going to bounce back from these last couple of games. I'm high on Edmonton. I think they've really turned a corner, but I'm going to take the Lions at home.
Yeah, I do really think that Edmonton had turned a corner. I was going to use that exact turn of phrase before you said it. I think they have, but I think the Lions find a way to win this one. They're on a 2-game slide here. I think they got it. They looked so good early in the season. Jennings has regressed a little bit, but I think they find a way to get it done in a very, very entertaining game between these two teams. So looks like the only game we got different is the Ottawa game this week. So hopefully I go 4-0 and you go 3-1.
Hopefully.
Okay, so we actually have some questions this week, Mike, and all three of them came from our main man, B. Broom on Twitter. Brian, always a loyal listener. I think he's been listening since day one. So he fired off a trio of questions. So let's start with the first one. This is pretty harsh. Cato is a baby with his sideline antics. Your thoughts? I don't think he has it. So what do you think?
I think he, I thought I saw it his first couple starts. I think it has gone away. Maybe he's being a baby because he's feeling disrespected by Carter and company. But yeah, I don't think there's really much of a future for Rakeem Cato in this league. I could be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's out of the league fairly quickly.
Yeah, for me, this is a wait and see as well. I kind of want to see what his attitude will be like now that those two biggest antagonists in Carter and Stafford are no longer on the team. But as we've touched on, Vernon Adams will start this week, so we probably won't really see what Cato can do without his two arch nemeses around. But I don't know. I think he's good enough to be at least a backup and a spot starter. I just think that I think you're right. I think a lot of it had to do with those two guys just kind of not getting along with him, and he doesn't get along with them. So now that they're gone, maybe we'll get to see a little bit more of what he can do.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, you might not even see it till next year. So
yeah, kind of wait and see, right? So the second question is a simple one. Thoughts on the Ticats' offensive play calling this year?
Well, I think it's been about the same. You know, we lost Tommy Condell. That might have hurt a bit. I pretty much guarantee it hurt a bit. But I'd have to say that the playbook probably stayed close to the same, if not the exact same. So, you know, Austin and him have been working on that offense for years now. So it's, you know, we talk about it every week. We wish they run the ball more. And that's one of the main concerns with this offense is that they don't run the ball. So that would be pretty much my only complaint. I think I'm happy with the offensive playbook. I think they have good plays in there, but run the ball more and I'll be even more happier.
Yeah, the
or more happy.
Yeah, not more happier. That's poor grammar. The offense is too one-dimensional. Like it's pretty much that simple. You look at the Ticats, so they're the highest scoring team in the East, which maybe doesn't mean much in this turtle derby of a division, but they are the highest scoring team in the East. They have a positive point differential. The defense hasn't been that scoring juggernaut that they were last year. So these are mostly coming from the offense. So the offense has been pretty good, but yeah, they don't run the ball enough. And that has been a problem since basically Austin got here. Although CJ Gable did have like 800 yards rushing his first year in the league. So it's really only been a problem since Gable got hurt in 2014. But yeah, that's pretty much the beginning. If they ran the ball more, I think this offense would be a lot more dynamic and maybe even score more points. Who knows? I just wish that they would find, like I said, when I was talking about earlier, I just wish they would find a better run pass balance. That's all.
Yeah, they got to have a more balanced attack. I like the pass happy stuff too, but it should be mixed in with running a bit. And I like our offensive schemes. I think they've proven to work over the years and I think they still can work. I look at a team like Toronto and I just hate what they do on offense. I think it's conservative. I think
It's boring football.
So boring. And they just do the dump down. Whoever's in there. I mean, I think LeFever ran that offense the best out of anyone this season on a consistent basis. But, you know, Willie's back there. Ray's back there. They just can't seem to make a decision. And it always seems to be dumped off to the running back. And then he gets tackled. And there you go, another punt. So if I was an Argos fan, I would be furious with that offensive playbook.
Yeah, and the thing is, Milanovic is a great offensive coordinator. Look what he did in Montreal. Look what he did in previous years in Toronto when he had some world-class playmakers there. But yeah, I'm with you. That Argos offense is boring to watch. And you're right. Dan LeFever, to me, the game he played against Hamilton was the most exciting the Argos have looked all year.
Besides the Ricky Ray Labor Day games.
Well, yeah, that's true. That was a thing of beauty. But yeah, good point. So the third and final question he asked, thoughts on the CFL overpricing of tickets and fans overreacting to it especially regarding the Grey Cup?
Well, yeah, I think the Grey Cup is overpriced. I think Toronto and the owners shot for the moon and are going to be pretty disappointed at the turnout, you know, depending on who's in it. Because some of those prices are just ludicrous, to be honest. And I've heard, you know, in different places, like I think in BC, the prices are really high. That's the David Braley thing, I believe, anyways. He likes to price the tickets high. I'm of the mindset, lower the ticket prices a bit and pack the stadium. Don't raise the ticket prices. And, you know, even though you'll make the same amount of money, it's just not good for the team down the road, I don't think. So I think there's some issues with ticket prices in the league. And, you know, some teams have them, some teams don't. I'm not sure. I think that Hamilton is fairly reasonable. I'm not sure. I'm not positive about that. I think Edmonton is fairly reasonable. I think they're cheaper than Hamilton, but I think there's problem areas like BC and maybe Montreal, maybe even Toronto that could, you know, lower ticket prices and get more fans in there and still make, you know, around the same amount of money. But the Grey Cup thing is just, they're going to have to take a look at it and, you know, evaluate their ticket prices for the years coming, because last year didn't sell out and this year's not going to sell out either.
Yeah, I don't agree with Brian that fans are overreacting to tickets being overpriced. That's not the word I would use. I think this all boils down to the CFL needing to decide what type of league it wants to be. If it wants to be a corporate behemoth like the NFL, then they continue doing what they're doing, because the big tickets will sell, those expensive tickets will sell, if they can find a way to sort of...
It's not a corporate league, though.
It's not. I agree. And that's where I'm going with this. I have no problems if the league wants to be that, because if they want to make a ton of money, that's their prerogative. But the thing is, if this league wants to remain a league for the fans, as they claim they are, then the pricing for events like Grey Cup needs to reflect that. And $900 to sit in the upper deck at the 10-yard line for a Grey Cup game is insane. I'm as diehard a fan as you can get of this league. I started a blog to talk about the Ticats. We started a podcast to talk about the CFL, because it's my passion. It's our passion. And I was doing these things to promote this league long before anyone paid me to do so. I was doing it. I was taking time out of my day, out of my free time, to write about the team, to podcast about the team, to podcast and talk about the league, because I love this league. And I cheer for a team that in June had legitimate Grey Cup aspirations. If you go back and look at people's predictions when it came to who was going to make the Grey Cup and who was going to win the Grey Cup, 9 out of 10 of those people, 90% of them, would have said the Ticats are getting there. This and this game is taking place probably 75 minutes from my front door, if you consider me walking to the car, driving to the venue, driving to parking, and walking to the venue. Like, it's as close to the Grey Cup as you can get without them actually playing it in Hamilton. Yet when I saw the tickets for the Grey Cup, I immediately passed. I said, I'm not paying this to go watch a championship game. I will sit in my basement with a giant 55-inch screen television and watch the game there. And if a guy like me is turned off based on pricing, then how does the CFL expect to attract people who don't live and breathe this league like you and I do? So the CFL, to me, has a decision to make. They can either lower prices so fans aren't turned away and reap a little less in profits, or they can continue to price themselves out of the market and deal with Grey Cups that no longer sell out. Because make no mistake, that is exactly what they are doing. They extended themselves, I think, too far with this year, and I thought people would pay anything to go to a Grey Cup. And as we've seen, this year they won't, and last year in Winnipeg they didn't, and I think that proves it. So the CFL needs to figure out what they want to be. Do they want to be a league for the fans, or do they want to be a league that caters to corporate needs? It's up to them. You can't have it both ways.
They're like, people are, corporations aren't going to buy season tickets. Like, maybe they will, like some of them will, to CFL games or, you know, the Grey Cup game and stuff like that. But make no mistake, this isn't the Toronto Maple Leafs, you know, where anyone, they're clamoring for tickets no matter how they play, no matter how much they raise the ticket prices. The CFL just doesn't have that power, especially in Ontario. So they had a streak of Grey Cup selling out for, you know, a good 10 years, I'm guessing, something like that. And that, I'm assuming they kept raising it, see how far they could go. Well, they went too far. So now it's time to reel it back and get back to a fans league, like you said. You know, a lot of people can't afford that. I couldn't afford $900 to go to one game. Are you crazy? I mean, I couldn't do that. So, yeah, they need to really look themselves in the mirror and, you know, reevaluate. I mean, the Grey Cup's in Ottawa next year. I don't know what ticket prices are going to be like there, but if they're anything like Toronto, they're going to have another tough sell.
Well, the people in Ottawa seem to think the price that Ottawa will learn from this mistake and the prices won't be as high. But there's fewer seats in Ottawa than there are in Toronto. So if to all the Red Blacks fans and the Ottawa fans out there that think that the tickets for Grey Cup in Ottawa in 2017 are going to be so much cheaper than they are in Toronto, you're in for a rude awakening. They honestly are. And the thing is, I pay less than $500 for my season tickets to the Ticats. I'm not paying twice that much to go to one game. So, like I said, the CFL needs to figure out what they want to be. Do they want to be a league that caters to corporations, which don't care about this league, or do they want to cater to the fans who live and breathe this football league and have helped keep it afloat all these years when they were in their downtimes and now that they're in some sort of an uptime? I just don't get it. And the thing is, and this is, I've had this discussion with people, if they lower ticket prices, and I'm not saying you have to drop them drastically, there's obviously a break-even point, and I think the league needs to get there. You drop ticket prices and pack those stadiums, all those fans are there, are buying concessions, are buying merchandise. My dad got season tickets for the first time this year, and he was off today, and he's got a jersey, and he wants to get a crest. And I said, hey, why don't we go down to the store and find out how much it is? And he was like, well, I can't go down to the store, because if I go down there, I'm going to drop $100 at the store on some merchandise. Because he's a season ticket holder now, and he's invested in the team, and he's excited to watch Ticats football. And he always has been, but now he's more so because he's going to the games. And that's what you do. You get people in the stadiums and they get excited about this product. I think it's worth more than a couple of $1,000 here and there. And think about all the extra concessions you're going to sell, like I said, and all the extra merchandise you're going to sell. I think you'll make up for it with other revenue streams. I don't know. I don't think fans are overreacting to the prices, and I absolutely don't think they're overreacting to the prices for Grey Cup, because if that's the case, then I overreacted, and I'm not going to Grey Cup because of it. So that's pretty much all I have to say.
I mean, and for return customers, what would you rather go to? A crowd like at BMO Field, or a sold-out crowd like in Ottawa or Hamilton, or a big crowd in Edmonton, or a big crowd in Saskatchewan, or whatever? I mean, it's, people love the atmosphere. You know, if it seems like it's a hot ticket, or like it's just a good time being there, no matter what's going on in the field, then people will come back. People aren't going to come back if it's overly priced and a half-empty stadium. It's just the way it is.
If it looks like a big deal, people will treat it like a big deal, and it'll feel like a big deal.
Yep.
Pretty much it.
Yep, that's about it.
All right, so before we get out of here, I just want to remind everyone again about the CFL Fans Fight Cancer event in Toronto during Grey Cup Week. It will take place on Saturday, November the 26th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Shoeless Joe's, which is located at 276 King Street West in Toronto. All the proceeds for this event will benefit the Wellspring Downtown Toronto facility. So if you are going to be someone who actually is going to Grey Cup in Toronto this year, head down to Shoeless Joe's on the 26th and help raise some money for a great cause. That's it, Mike. We are done for the day. We are done for the week. Good show, buddy. Thought you brought some excellent analysis this week.
Thank you, sir. You as well.
Thank you very much. So you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to it or download it at 3downnation.com. If you want to ask Mike or myself a question, and I think that ticket price one is going to generate a lot of conversation throughout the week when people get a chance to hear that, you can hit us up on Twitter. Mike, your Twitter handle, please.
Mike_Ticats.
And I am JoshSmith_82. And, of course, you can always post those questions you have for us in the comments section on 3 Down Nation. So, that was episode 61 of Podski Wee Wee. I am Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw. And go Cubs.